This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Greater Boston has long been home to one of the largest Haitian communities in the United States, and that community has been growing in the last year as Haitian families flee violence and lawlessness in the island nation. In Haiti, the chaos has worsened. Gangs largely have control of the streets of its capital, Port-au-Prince. They broke thousands of people out of prisons, shut down the airport, and then successfully demanded the resignation of the prime minister 3 days ago. With us today to talk about how that is resonating here, Professor Patrick Sylvain. He is a writer, poet, and faculty member at Simmons University, and Carlene Desiree, executive director of the Association of Haitian Women in Dorchester. Patrick Sylvain, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you for being here. And Carlene Desiree, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be part of this dialogue.
We appreciate it. And I'll just note we've got a little bit of delay on your line, Carlene, just noting that for our listeners. Patrick, I'll start with you. Do you have loved ones, community still on the ground in Haiti?
I do. I have cousins and nephews and, of course, close friends. A close friend of mine I went to school with, I was talking to him yesterday, actually. And one of the things that he said is, it feels like he is in prison, right? Cannot venture out. And so that's the unfortunate theme. And of course, me wanting to go back cannot, and that it is very difficult.
Carlene, how about you? Do you still have people you're close to in country in Haiti?
Yes, I do. I have folks in Port-au-Prince, in Pétionville, and Biavale, and it's been difficult to communicate with them for a long time.
I can't imagine, Carlene, in this moment, not being able to reach people you care about, not being able to check in on them.
Yeah, it's really a situation where people are saddened by what's happening in Haiti because it affects all of us. Definitely, it's the direct impact when it comes to the folks living in the country, but also those outside of the country, whether they be in the United States, in France, you name it. You know, we all have some type of extension in Haiti, and it's been really difficult not being able to connect with our loved ones.
Patrick, you're nodding.
Yeah. I mean, for me, not only as a scholar, but also as a writer, the impact is, it feels emotionally draining. Right. And it feels as though this crisis is the worst one. And of course, we've said that in 2010. We said it in 2021 when the president was assassinated.
So 2010 being the
earthquake. Yeah. Absolutely. And we thought that would have been the moment to sort of gather our strength and move forward in reconstructions and so forth. And it's just been chaos after chaos. But this time, we feel that it is so chaotic that no one has a grip on it. And it's affecting so many different people. Even spots in Haiti, normally that would have been relatively quiet and safe, sort of in the northwest of Haiti, for example. But it's impacting everywhere, including Dominican Republic, with folks fleeing, and of course, the United States as well, right? The notions of the migrations and so forth. So it is draining.
Carlene, it really strikes me to hear Patrick say, we thought we had seen the worst and said it was the worst in 2010 with the earthquake, then in 2021 with the assassination of the president. Over the last couple of years, I know you have been hearing from families coming to the state really hard stories. I can't imagine what it must be like for a family who's already had a hard story to tell to now be looking at those they left behind and knowing that there's a harder story still that their loved ones who are stuck are facing. What are you hearing from the families you're working with and talking to?
Well, you know, a couple of weeks ago when the gangs decided to let 4,100 prisoners out of jail, and you saw a lot of people getting so anxious and and they shot a lot of people against themselves, and people were devastated, not being able to communicate. And some of our families, I said the Afab family, some of our women kept repeating how gut-wrenching they can't really connect with people. And some of them are stuck in Port-au-Prince. They don't have anywhere to stay. Some people were trying to flee out of Port-au-Prince to go to Cap-Haïtien Station, which is one of the towns that's somewhat relatively safe. So it's a lot of grief, a lot of sadness, and we did have several dialogues, and there's one particular woman who cried because she just couldn't control the tears. Yeah, they're thankful that they can go out, they can eat, but not only there remains a huge challenge in Haiti, but also they are facing some challenges here in the States as well.
I want to talk about both of those pieces, Carlene and Patrick, the challenges in Haiti and the challenges here. We're speaking with Carlene Desiree, who's executive director of the Association of Haitian Women, and Patrick Sylvain, who is a professor and a writer at Simmons. Patrick, I'll come back to you. I don't want to do the long version, but I do at least want to do the short version of how we got here. I mean, there is a several hundred year history for Haiti from the moment of its freedom, of France, of the United States, demanding payment reparations. France demanded reparations from Haitians for ending slavery. The United States took 40% of the Haitian economic economy for years after occupation. I do think a little bit of that history is important to situate us in this moment.
Absolutely. So in a sense, we are paying for daring, right, to rise up and declare that slavery is going to be over. And not only that, Haiti became the beacon, right, for so many different countries. And as a matter of fact, my family is the Sylvains, a byproduct of the Haitian Revolution. We are, in a sense, many generations from African Americans who left the United States to go to Haiti. Right? My family left Pennsylvania in 1822 to go to Haiti because Haiti offered freedom to so many different people. However, one of the things that we are really paying for, it's not only in terms of our natural resources, but the daring for independence from France. But the United States did not recognize Haiti's independence until 1825, right? And one of the reasons was for Haiti to recognize that Rome had sovereignty over Haiti's education and religion. So in 1860, we sign what is called a concordat with Rome, giving Haiti's sovereignty to the Europeans, in a sense. And then, of course, by the 1890s, we had one major campaign, which is the anti-Vaudoun campaign, where many of the peasants were killed. And of course, 1915, my parents' land in the south of Haiti were seized in Miagwan, because we had bauxite, right? So in a sense, our migration,
mining
right? Our migration from Miagwan to Port-au-Prince and to here, it's a direct result of the occupation. And of course, sadly, is in 1915, under President Wilson, right? Thinking there are two things that happened. One, in April of 1915, at the White House, the movie Birth of the Nation was shown, right? July 1915, Haiti is occupied.
So for listeners, Birth of the Nation, well understood to be a racist anti-black movie shown in the White House. Long history of that film.
Absolutely. And one of the secretaries said, imagine the N-words speaking French, right? So already the point of view is that, A, we are not a normal human being. Even the French language does not sort of belong to us. And we moved from 1915 to dismantling sort of the Haitian army and so forth. So since then, we've been under a U.S. dominating control, choosing presidents, including absorbing and accepting the Duvaliers because they were anti-communists.
So first Papa Doc, the nickname, then Baby Doc. So that's really 1957 all the way to 1986.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to play a bit of sound here as we then transition to what's happening here in the United States as well. On Monday, on NPR's All Things Considered, they asked Daniel Foote, who's a former U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti, about whether the U.S. should get involved in Haiti now, and here is what he said.
Let's let the Haitians have a chance to mess up Haiti for once. The international community has messed it up beyond recognition countless times. I guarantee the Haitians mess it up less than the Americans.
So, Carlene, I'll turn to you now. Now, we have Haitian families coming to Massachusetts. We know that we have an emergency shelter overflow happening. I want to play a little sound from our reporter, WBUR's former reporter, Gabriella Emmanuel. This is the end of January, speaking with a Haitian-American man named DaCosta, who at that time was staying at Logan Airport waiting for permanent housing.
Come sleep in airports, and in the morning we come again. And over
every day.
Every day. Now it's day 10. Yes.
Do you sleep okay?
No, of course. No. It's so cold. It's cold. I'm cold too. And we have no bed. I don't want to be rude, but I think this is the politicians and the government sometimes don't care. Yeah.
You get the feeling they don't care.
Yes, yes.
Now, since then, more overflow shelters opened. Also, we've seen Nazi organizations show up outside hotels where the Haitian community have been staying as part of the emergency shelter system. We have seen pushback and increasingly anti-immigrant language in some communities. Put that in context, Carlene.
Mm-hmm. I want to say definitely, overall, Haitians are grateful. And they are adjusting to a new environment, climate, and feeling isolated at times. Now, of course, we have had some challenges, but we see a lot of camaraderie, you know, with the different families. And overall, what I say is true. We hear it over and over again that they are thankful for being here and the help that they get. Now, the challenges with the housing piece it's still a problem, and we have the overflow shelters. There's one opening, I think, toward the one at the seaport. Now, it's just that a lot of the folks feel challenged, not being able to get jobs, and this is primarily due to the language barrier and lack of transportation. Like, we work with a group in one of the shelters. We won't mention which one, but over and over again, even the people that have work permits, they're not getting any jobs. And
people who have work permits are still not finding work?
They're not finding work, and I think it has to do with speaking English as well, and lack of medical needs. You know, it's been difficult to get doctors, to get specialists, because we have certain folks with very acute medical needs. And also, it's dealing with the isolation. There's more argument taking place among parents due to their frustration, not being able to secure a job or lack of finances. Now, remember, you mentioned the connection directly from here from the States to Haiti. They have folks that are relying on them as well. So it's not just a matter of, a lot of the folks are getting some assistance, you know, but it's the fact that they want to work and be able to provide for others left back home. So that's a problem. And we do see an increase with domestic violence. We have had two women who committed suicide, and those kids end up going in the care of the Department of Children and Families. And we received a phone call yesterday regarding another shelter with DV cases. As you know, if there's a lot of argument fighting taking place, the people at the hotels or the other shelters, they call the cops. And that's another level of frustration. So there are a lot of other things they mentioned, but I think the prominent thing is you know, they need to find a way to learn the language. They need to get jobs. And having those two needs met, that doesn't mean there won't be any challenges in relations to husband and wife or girlfriend, boyfriend. But once you have that possibility of getting a job, learning the language, getting a job, I think things will improve significantly for the families here.
And tremendous.
Overall, I will say that folks, the Haitian folks, are thankful.
A tremendous amount of trauma that you're talking about there, Carlene. And I'll note that you talked about a couple of deaths by suicide. If you or someone you love in the listening audience are experiencing a mental health crisis, you can dial 988 or text it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That is a nationwide mental health crisis hotline where you can receive support and assistance. It's a lot. And members of our community are experiencing this trauma, experiencing this strain, the diaspora sending remittances back to Haiti, the inability to work, it's a lot. I think, Patrick Sylvain, what I'd like to do as we go out is ask you to share a bit of your writing with us. You wrote a poem, you brought it. I think it would be a lovely way to close. Before I say goodbye to the two of you, would you mind reading it for us?
Sure. Scorching Dreams. You were once an Atlantic beacon that lit dreams for enchained bodies singing your name with hopeful notes, Haiti, Aitai, Haiti. Now voices are choked with lumps of burning coal in black throats. Someone is scorching you alive, mirroring the way plantations were charred. Someone is sipping scotch, smooth, dark ember, blended malt, sharp on the throat. There is money to be made on your back. Your gut is filled with minerals. While your children gag on scotch bonnet, someone is drinking scotch, hooding the future with boys like wolves. In broad daylight, hopeless men turning werewolves hunt their own shadows in depleted streets where babies cast glances towards elsewhere. You, Haiti, were once a beacon, a heaven for black, for all backs carved by whips of unfreedom. Now, your hand-wringing children flee with hearts ablaze.
Patrick Sylvain, poet, writer, faculty at Simmons University. Carlene Desiree, executive director of the Association of Haitian Women. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.